This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA FM and Pacifica Syndication. Ian McEwan is considered today one of the leading English language literary authors. Since 1978, he's had 17 novels published, and there have been 10 film adaptations of his works, along with an additional 3 original screenplays that were produced. He has been nominated for the Booker Prize 6 times, winning for Amsterdam in 1998. On April 3, 2002, I interviewed Ian McEwan in New York City while he was publicizing his now classic novel, Atonement. This interview has not been heard in over 2 decades. I would interview him again in 2010 for his novel, Solar. Ian McEwan, I've been looking through your books trying to find various themes, and I know that others have sensed themes, and one that keeps coming up through all 3 books, Atonement, Enduring Love, and Amsterdam, seems to be focusing on characters who either make mistakes or have mistakes made about them, either deliberately or accidentally. In other words, their lives change on the basis of something that's ephemeral, a fiction.
Well, I suppose I've always been interested in character. And as Henry James famously said, driving force of character is incident. And the driving force, I'm glossing what he said, but the driving force of incident is character. I have an interest in the accidental. I'm no great believer in fate or destiny. I'm also an atheist. I don't believe in supervening supernatural powers in our life. And I know from my own experience, just when you drive down the highway and see the contents of a car spilled across the road and people injured, that lives can just be transformed in a second. If you think of us as sort of millions of little particles bumping into each other in our daily encounters, this seems to me really the stuff of fiction. I suppose, too, in if you see fiction as a kind of investigation, an investigation into human nature, you'll want to know more about a character by pursuing some intense kind of incident. So therefore, in Enduring Love, dramatic scene at the beginning of the novel, a ballooning accident. In other novels, like Black Dogs, there's a confrontation of a young woman to fierce animals that really changes her life. Similarly, in The Child in Time, a child is snatched from a supermarket, and this has ramifications for the main character and his wife, forcing them apart, forcing them into different forms of introspection. And Atonement really is part of that pattern, I suppose, but rather different in that a young girl makes a fundamental error of judgment based on her infatuation with her own literary obsessions. So yes, I mean, it's part of the way of looking at character, of investigating human nature.
In the case of Enduring Love, the switch, the change, happens fairly early on. Amsterdam hinges at the very beginning on the first sentence of the book. The difference with Atonement is this doesn't happen. This event you're speaking of doesn't happen until fully a third of the way into the book. Why the shift in Atonement?
Atonement's a very different kind of novel. Set in 1935, I've found that one way of evoking the period was to somehow imitate the language of a novel of the period. And so it became a form of ventriloquism by having one of the characters, actually, Bryony herself, become the author of this. It's more expansive. I'd had a notion that I wanted to explore the matter by using different points of view. These points of view would overlap slightly in time, so each chapter is slightly interleaved with the one before and the one after. It needs to build slowly. It's a psychological novel, I suppose, in this respect. And it's one of those moments, I suppose, of error that's got to be reflected upon for a lifetime. So the reader has to fully understand the import of it. It's not the sort of thing, if I try to imagine those events that evening, Bryony, Lola, the shadowy figure who is perpetrating this assault, if this were all to happen on the first page, I think it would matter not a jot, because you wouldn't know who any of these people were. So the reader needs to be sort of fully trained up, if you like, into an acquaintanceship, deep acquaintanceship, with not only the characters, but with the sort of weight of this, the sheer weight of this.
It's also operating on multiple levels, in that Brioni is writing the tale, and she may be an unreliable narrator. Was that something you knew from the start?
No, I knew very little at the start. I mean, I often just blunder into my novels. I have to kind of... I have to write them in order to find out what's going to happen in them. I mean, literally. I started with a little scrap of a couple of paragraphs, which are now the beginnings of chapter two of the novel. I have a young girl entering a room with some wild flowers in her hand. She's looking for a vase. There's a young man out in the garden. He's someone that she both wants to talk to and avoid. So I looked at these 600 words, and I'd been doodling like this for 15 months or so, and thought, well, one thing I knew was I'd started a novel, that these particular sentences would unlock all kinds of material that I'd been pondering for some years, but I didn't quite know how. I didn't know when this was. I didn't know who this girl was. And slowly I pieced together what is now the second chapter. She goes to the fountain, she gets water from her vase, she engages in a rather tense conversation with a young man, the vase breaks, she climbs into the fountain to retrieve two pieces of the vase, and then she storms off. And then I thought, well, what the hell is this? And what is this about? So I then found myself thinking, well, I'll give her a sister. And so I began a chapter about 13-year-old Bryony, infatuated by writing, a rather priggish, conceited girl, trying to put on a play because her cousins from the north are arriving. They're refugees from a bitter domestic domestic strife. And by the time I'd finished that second chapter, I knew a couple of things. I knew that Bryony was the author. I knew that I was going to write a novel about a terrible error that she was going to commit that night. And I knew that the year was 1935. I knew also that at last I would find a way through to write my father's experiences at Dunkirk. So if you ask me what I knew at the beginning, next to nothing, but within 2 months, I knew enough. I mean, I had a roadmap, as it were, ahead of me.
But at that time, you did know that the theme, the underlying theme, would be the title of the book, which is Atonement, or an attempt at atonement.
Yes, I mean, I think I had the title, although right at the beginning, and actually right till the end, I was calling it An Atonement, which is rather a mouthful, but was quite specific. It was not... I didn't even think of it as a theme. In fact, I don't think of themes. I don't find it's readers and critics who necessarily have to think thematically. I didn't really think that I would now write a book about atonement. I was writing about a specific event, and it was an atonement that she was going to carry out. But I think probably I'm not unusual among novelists in having to be taught by the novel how to write it, and each novel teaches you afresh.
I've talked to enough writers over the years to know that if you ask a writer, how do you write a book, their response is, I have no idea. And when I start a new one, I have no idea how the heck I'm going to do it. Is that pretty much the same with you then?
Yes, I'm sort of always baffled by that simplest of questions and the most frequently asked questions of reading. Where do you get your ideas from? It's a killer of a question, really. Sometimes I say, well, I get them from the same place you get your ideas from. I had dinner with Steve Martin the other day. We had a very lively evening, and he asked me, what's the question people ask you most? And I told him, where'd you get your ideas from? And I said, well, what would you say to that? And he said, I'd say, well, where do you get your questions from? Can't you do better than that? But that's unfair. I mean, I think it's always a matter of interest where an artist gets his or her materials. We all want to know that. But we also know, in a way, that we're pursuing something that can never be told to us. I mean, where does Picasso get his ideas from? I don't know what kind of answer Picasso, if he were alive, could ever give us that would satisfy us.
But it strikes me that the question is not really where do you get your ideas, because there's an idea every second. The question is, how do you translate that idea into a book? It would seem to me, and it happens to a number of writers, that when they start with the idea, they might get that chapter that became the second chapter, and then a third, and then a fourth, and then they suddenly hit a dead end, or it's suddenly a short story. There's got to be a point where you suddenly realize, damn, this is a book.
Well, I knew it straight away. I mean, I knew as soon as I'd written those 600 words that they were like a sort of key. The door I was pushing against was really stuff that had been going on around in my mind for maybe 10 or 12 years, little scraps of things. And I just had a hunch that they could all at last come together in something. That was all. But how to get all this material into one place, as it were, within one framework, you can only learn by... Well, I can only learn by attention to detail. You can't think, well, I'm going to write a novel about lost innocence and the power of the imagination and the difficulty of expiating a crime and so on. I think to myself, who is this girl and what's she going to do? What's she like? And what does she look like? Or what's her room look like? Or what's the relationship between herself and her mother or her sister? I like the specific. I was reading some Melville the other day, and I was thinking, why am I getting bored so quickly? And I knew I was actually thumbing pages of Redfern, looking for the marvelous scenes, which I remember. But lying in between them are pages and pages of summary. And I thought, well, I'm learning something here, because what I personally like in Melville is when there is something happening, as it were, in real fictional time, rather than a period of weeks being summarized over 10 scores of pages. So it's the specific, I think, that I like to attend to, and out of that will grow enough of a body of 5,000, 10,000 words to begin to indicate where one should go with this.
Well, it sounds from the way you describe your writing that the book itself comes out of the characters surprising you, figure out who they are, then they take on lives of their own and take the book in directions you would never have expected. Is that correct?
It's not quite that. I mean, Lawrence famously said about, you know, if you try and nail a character down, it sort of walks away with the floorboard. I don't quite have that experience. For me, it's narrower than that. Often I get a whole character out of a sentence. I mean, I write a sentence and it appeals to me, something about the ring of it, and it generates another. And out of those will come possibly the first indications of a character. Sometimes, for example, characters appear in a morning that I had no plans for. When I was writing the opening paragraphs of Dunkirk, I thought that I was really just going to be concentrating on Robbie walking alone to the coast. I had no plans for companions for him. But I found myself writing a sentence about him dropping his overcoat and looking for the map and realizing it was in his left hand. And then suddenly I had these two figures standing nearby, smoking a cigarette, staring away into the distance. And before I knew it, I'd given them names that came from nowhere, Corporal Mace and Corporal Nettle. There was nothing to do but sort of go with them and find out, you know, what, realizing, of course, straight away how useful it was to have two people, far more texture than my original intention, which is to have Robbie walk towards the coast, reflecting on all that had happened to him in prison and his love for Cecilia and so on.
You mentioned before that you wanted to include your father's own experiences at Dunkirk. There were certain events that struck me as real. Now, I don't know if they were or not. The mother and the child running through the field, and the other was the poor guy from the RAF who gets confronted by the people who are trying to escape. Are those events from your imagination, or do they have a basis in history?
The mother and child were complete inventions. But it's certainly the case that there was a lot of hostility from ordinary soldiers towards the RAF because they felt they weren't being protected enough. And my father said he had seen a humble RAF clerk lynched on the beach. And I think Churchill himself made a speech in the Commons calling on army personnel to desist from this violence. It was very hard for British fighters operating from the south coast of Britain. They'd lost all their airfields in France, you see, so they were having to fly across the Channel. They'd only have about 40 minutes combat time. And more than that, I think the aim was to hold back, not commit too many fighter planes to the skies, because they knew that any invasion of the British Isles by the Germans would have to be preceded by a fight for supremacy of the air. So they knew they had to keep these fighters in reserve. So there were very good reasons, but down on the ground, it was a very different matter, and people took their anger out on the, you know, completely innocent filing clerks and telephonists.
There's an epigraph from Jane Austen at the beginning of the book. Did that come at the beginning, or was that something that you realized at the end of the book, that it would help contextualize the material in the book?
It was there from the moment I decided that Bryony was a busy little conceited teenage girl who was a writer. I'd always admired Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey. I loved the character Catherine Morland. Her infatuation with Gothic novels causes her to make some very basic errors of judgment. I'd fished out Northanger Abbey more or less towards the end of writing that chapter in which Bryony stages or tries to stage her play. When the play fails to get put on because the children can't get it together, and Bryony more or less decides at that point she's not going to be a playwright anyway, she's going to be a novelist, I knew then that I had a very important piece of structure, which is I knew this play would be staged at the end of Bryony's life in the very place where it was meant to be staged, that is the library of the house, which would by then be a hotel. All that was clear even as I was inventing a few lines from the prologue for it.
There's a long segment in which Bryony is a nurse, and we learn about what it was like for the nurses and the doctors when the people came back from Dunkirk. What kind of research did you do into that?
I got the material for the wartime nursing from exactly the same place as I got the best and most intimate details of Dunkirk, which is in the library of the Imperial War Museum in London. It's a marvelous museum. It's set in an old madhouse, Bethlehem, which is Bedlam. You were always escorted by a sort of a commissar type figure in a tiny lift up into the dome of this building. You can never leave the building alone either. So it's quite a sort of awkward procedure. They bring you, the librarians will bring you boxes of old letters, diaries, memoirs, reminiscences, and I found marvelous accounts of young girls, often sort of rather posh, upper-class girls who had never really done anything. I mean, and had always lived at home and were very close to their mummies and their daddies, writing absolutely heartfelt, homesick letters, some of them even blotchy, I thought, with tears. And these girls were initiated into the harshest of regimes for nursing training. The Florence Nightingale School, which is the one I based this around, was at St. Thomas's Hospital, just across the river from the Houses of Parliament. Florence Nightingale had got her notions of nursing from military discipline. So nursing was very structured around a kind of militaristic principle of total obedience, meaningless tasks that girls had to do in order to learn unthinking obedience to whoever was above them. There was a sort of fanatical devotion to cleanliness. And really, a lot of nursing was this sort of glorified punitive housework and tidiness. I mean, I read one girl saying, you know, we have to every day make sure that the little casters on the beds are all facing the same way. And when there's a general inspection of the ward, the patients must be arranged in the bed so that the center crease of the sheet is dead center on their chest. So the patients had to be organized. And the other thing, I suppose a little hilarious to us now and sort of rather revolting, was the notion of bed rest. If you're in hospital with whatever, for whatever reason, you therefore were in bed and you didn't get out of bed. And so a lot of nursing was humping bedpans up and down the wards for these people who could perfectly easily have gone to the bathroom themselves. So, you know, really, really tough regimes of very, very low-level work. And I thought that in many ways for Bryony, who's given up a place at Cambridge to study literature, to enter into this world was a sort of beginning of an atonement process. She follows her sister into this, her sister whom she has wronged by ruining her love affair. This is the beginning of a kind of atonement.
But no atonement can really be possible, or can it?
Very difficult, because if Bryony's writing this novel, setting all the terms and conditions, she is playing God. And who can forgive her? Who can forgive God? No one, she concludes, can forgive God, because there's no higher power. So who can forgive Bryony? Well, only herself, and she can't quite do it. She does tell herself, though, that the attempt is probably all that she can make. I mean, that the attempt is all, she says. So yes, no, it's just a very difficult process. I mean, if you've done something horrendous, I'm not sure that you can ever quite expiate. I mean, I suppose for people who are really firmly believing Catholics, for example, and they could get absolution from a priest, which strikes me as a somewhat fatuous process of alleviating you from the real business of a dialogue with your own conscience. I suppose for such people, absolution is possible. You know, you say the Hail Marys or whatever you're told to do, and your sins are washed clean. That seems to me almost morally a kind of infantile procedure. The world is much tougher and more difficult morally than that. So I never gave Bryony that out. she has to live with her own thoughts on this.
Ian McEwan, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about a couple of other of your books, your most recent books. Enduring Love hinges on something called the de Clarembault syndrome. Does that really exist?
Oh, it certainly does, yes. De Clarembault was a French forensic psychiatrist. He was working between the wars, mostly. He worked for the Metropolitan, the French police. He saw many, many forms of craziness. He himself was pretty loopy. He committed suicide standing in front of a mirror, shot himself through the head. And he gave his name to the syndrome of erotomania, in which the sufferer becomes completely convinced that the object of his desires is returning that love. So it's a kind of psychosis. It's a psychotic delusional state. Nothing that the victim of a declarambo sufferer, nothing that victim can say will persuade the sufferer that there isn't love between the two of them. I did think at first that Jed Parry was simply a religious fanatic, but I realized actually that's not enough and maybe not interesting enough to me at that point. And then I remembered some old newspaper cuttings I had about declarambos, and I thought, that's what he's got.
After Enduring Love, you wrote a novel called Amsterdam. And when I was done with Amsterdam, and in reflecting back upon your other works, it strikes me that writing of that may have been very different because the ending is so important to the beginning. Was that, again, a novel that grew out of character, or did you know what was going on at the beginning and the end as you began writing it?
Well, Amsterdam's much more light-hearted kind of thing. It was a sort of jeu d'esprit. No, this was different. This was a back-of-the-envelope kind of business. I had the whole scheme. I didn't have any of the characters, but I have an old friend. We often go hiking together. And as we got into our 40s, as often happens, we found that one or the other of us would forget things, forget an essential piece of equipment. We'd had this conversation that, a jokey conversation, that if one of us starts to go under with, say, Alzheimer's, the other would take him over to Amsterdam and have him sort of legally put down. So if my friend Ray would turn up and he'd forgotten his hiking socks, or if I turned up at the airport on the wrong day, one of us would say to the other, well, it's Amsterdam for you, pal. So, and it was really out of this sort of silly kind of running joke that this novel came about. People in Holland were very upset by this novel. I don't know what happened to it in translation. I think it lost its air of jocularity. So I got many letters from angry Dutch people saying, you have impugned our nation. You cannot have people put down simply because they're depressed. You cannot bribe our doctors. Its structure was essentially comic. It was an extravaganza.
You've been listening to an interview with novelist and screenwriter Ian McEwan, recorded on April 3rd, 2002, in New York City. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky radio shows on Facebook.